Chapter 18. Observable. Keepers likewise given this morning to standing about solitary, with their hands in their pockets, looking down at their boots as they fit them into cracks of the pavement, and then looking up whistling and walking away. Grand Alliance Circus out, in procession. Buxom lady member of Grand Alliance, in crimson riding habit, fresher to look at, even in her paint under the day sky, than the cheeks of lunatics or keepers. Spanish cavalier appears to have lost yesterday, and jingles his bossed bridle with disgust, as if he were paying. Reaction also apparent at the Guildhall opposite, when certain pickpockets come out handcuffed together, with that peculiar walk which is never seen under any other circumstances, a walk expressive of going to jail, game, but still of jails being in bad taste and arbitrary, and how would you like it, if it was you instead of me, as it ought to be? Midday. Town filled as yesterday, but not so full. And emptied as yesterday, but not so empty. In the evening, Angel Ordinary, where every lunatic and keeper has his modest daily meal of turtle, venison, and wine, not so crowded as yesterday, and not so noisy. At night, the theater. More abstracted faces in it than one ever sees at public assemblies. Such faces wearing an expression which strongly reminds Mr. Goodchild of the boys at school who were going up next, apostrophe with their arithmetic or mathematics. These boys are, no doubt, going up tomorrow with their sums and figures. Mr. Palmer and Mr. Thurtell in the boxes OP Mr. Thurtell and Mr. Palmer in the boxes PS. The firm of Thurtell, Palmer, and Thurtell, in the boxes center. A most odious tendency observable in these distinguished gentlemen, to put vile constructions on sufficiently innocent phrases in the play, and then to applaud them in a satyr-like manner. Behind Mr. Goodchild, with a party of other lunatics and one keeper, the express incarnation of the thing called a gent. Apostrophe a gentleman born, a gent manufactured. A something with a scarf round its neck, and a slipshod speech issuing from behind the scarf. More depraved, more foolish, more ignorant, more unable to believe in any noble or good thing of any kind, than the stupidest posgesman. The thing is but a boy in years, and is addled with drink. To do its company justice, even its company is ashamed of it, as it drawls its slang criticisms on the representation, and inflames Mr. Goodchild with a burning ardor to fling it into the pit. Its remarks are so horrible, that Mr. Goodchild, for the moment, even doubts whether that is a wholesome art, which sets women apart on a high floor before such a thing as this, though as good as its own sisters, or its own mother whom heaven forgive for bringing it into the world. But, the consideration that a low nature must make a low world of its own to live in, whatever the real materials, or it could no more exist than any of us could without the sense of touch, brings Mr. Goodchild to reason. The rather, because the thing soon drops its downy chin upon its scarf, and slobbers itself asleep. Friday morning. Early fights. Gong donkey, and correct cards. Again, a great set towards the races, though not so great a set as on Wednesday. Much packing going on too, upstairs at the gunsmiths, the wax chandlers, and the serious stationers. For there will be a heavy drift of lunatics and keepers to London by the afternoon train. The course as pretty as ever, the great pincushion, as like a pincushion, but not nearly so full of pins, whole rows of pins wanting. On the great event of the day, both lunatics and keepers become inspired with rage, and there is a violent scuffling, and a rushing at the losing jockey, and an emergence of the said jockey from a swaying and menacing crowd, protected by friends, and looking the worse for wear, which is a rough proceeding, though animating to see from a pleasant distance. After the great event, rills begin to flow from the pincushion towards the railroad. The rills swell into rivers, the rivers soon unite into a lake. The lake floats Mr. Goodchild into Doncaster, past the itinerant personage in black, by the wayside telling him from the vantage ground of a legibly printed placard on a pole, that for all these things the Lord will bring him to judgment. No turtle and venison ordinary this evening, that is all over. No bedding at the rooms, nothing there but the plants in pots, which have, all the week, been stood about the entry, to give it an innocent appearance, and which have sorely sickened by this time. Saturday. Mr. Idle wishes to know at breakfast, what were those dreadful groanings in his bedroom doorway in the night. Mr. Goodchild answers, nightmare. Mr. Idle repels the calumny, and calls the waiter. The angel is very sorry had intended to explain, but you see, gentlemen, there was a gentleman dined downstairs with two more, and he had lost a deal of money, and he would drink a deal of wine, and in the night he took the horse, apostrophe and got up, and as his friends could do nothing with him, he laid himself down and groaned at Mr. Idle's door. And he did groan there, apostrophe Mr. Idle says, and you will please to imagine me inside, taking the horse too. Apostrophe apostrophe, so far, the picture of Doncaster on the occasion of its great sporting anniversary, offers probably a general representation of the social condition of the town, in the past as well as in the present time. The sole local phenomenon of the current year, which may be considered as entirely unprecedented in its way, and which certainly claims, on that account, some slight share of notice, consists in the actual existence of one remarkable individual, who is sojourning in Doncaster, and who, neither directly nor indirectly, has anything at all to do, in any capacity whatever, with the racing amusements of the week. Ranging throughout the entire crowd that fills the town, and including the inhabitants as well as the visitors, nobody is to be found altogether disconnected with the business of the day, excepting this one unparalleled man. He does not bet on the races, like the sporting men. He does not assist the races, like the jockeys, starters, judges, and grooms. He does not look on at the races, like Mr. Goodchild and his fellow spectators. He does not profit by the races, like the hotel keepers and the tradespeople. He does not minister to the necessities of the races, like the booth keepers, the postilions, the waiters, and the hawkers of lists. He does not assist the attractions of the races, like the actors at the theater, the riders at the circus, or the posturers at the poses plastiques. Absolutely and literally, he is the only individual in Doncaster who stands by the brink of the full-flowing race stream, and is not swept away by it in common with all the rest of his species. Who is this modern hermit, this recluse of the St. Leger week, this inscrutably ungregarious being, who lives apart from the amusements and activities of his fellow creatures? Surely, there is little difficulty in guessing that clearest and easiest of all riddles. Who could he be but Mr. Thomas Idle? Thomas had suffered himself to be taken to Doncaster, just as he would have suffered himself to be taken to any other place in the habitable globe which would guarantee him the temporary possession of a comfortable sofa to rest his ankle on. Once established at the hotel, with his leg on one cushion and his back against another, he formally declined taking the slightest interest in any circumstance, whatever connected with the races, or with the people who were assembled to see them. Francis Goodchild, anxious that the hours should pass by his crippled traveling companion as lightly as possible, suggested that his sofa should be moved to the window, and that he should amuse himself by looking out at the moving panorama of humanity, which the view from it of the principal street presented. Thomas, however, steadily declined profiting by the suggestion. The farther I am from the window, apostrophe he said, the better, Brother Francis, I shall be pleased. I have nothing in common with the one prevalent idea of all those people who are passing in the street. Why should I care to look at them? Apostrophe apostrophe, I hope I have nothing in common with the prevalent idea of a great many of them either, apostrophe answered Goodchild, thinking of the sporting gentleman whom he had met in the course of his wanderings about Doncaster. But, surely, among all the people who are walking by the house, at this very moment, you may find apostrophe, not one living creature, apostrophe interposed Thomas, who is not, in one way or another, interested in horses, and who is not, in a greater or less degree, an admirer of them. Now, I hold opinions in reference to these particular members of the quadruped creation, which may lay claim, as I believe, to the disastrous distinction of being unpartaken by any other human being, civilized or savage, over the whole surface of the earth. Taking the horse as an animal in the abstract, Francis, I cordially despise him from every point of view. Apostrophe, Thomas, apostrophe said good child. Confinement to the house has begun to affect your biliary secretions. I shall go to the chemist's and get you some physic. Apostrophe, I object, apostrophe continued Thomas, quietly possessing himself of his friend's hat, which stood on a table near him. I object, first, to the personal appearance of the horse. I protest against the conventional idea of beauty as attached to that animal. I think his nose too long, his forehead too low, and his legs, except in the case of the cart horse, ridiculously thin by comparison with the size of his body. Again, considering how big an animal he is, I object to the contemptible delicacy of his constitution. Is he not the sickliest creature in creation? Does any child catch cold as easily as a horse? Does he not sprain his fetlock, for all his appearance of superior strength, as easily as I sprained my ankle? Furthermore, to take him from another point of view, what a helpless wretch he is. No fine lady requires more constant waiting on than a horse. Other animals can make their own toilet. He must have a groom. You will tell me that this is because we want to make his coat artificially glossy. Glossy. Come home with me, and see my cat, my clever cat, who can groom herself. Look at your own dog. See how the intelligent creature curry combs himself with his own honest teeth. Then, again, what a fool the horse is, what a poor, nervous fool. He will start at a piece of white paper in the road, as if it was a lion. His one idea, when he hears a noise that he is not accustomed to, is to run away from it. What do you say to those two common instances of the sense and courage of this absurdly overpraised animal? I might multiply them to 200, if I chose to exert my mind and waste my breath, which I never do. I prefer coming at once to my last charge against the horse, which is the most serious of all, because it affects his moral character. I accuse him boldly, in his capacity of servant to man, of slyness and treachery. I brand him publicly, no matter how mild he may look about the eyes, or how sleek he may be about the coat, as a systematic betrayer, whenever he can get the chance, of the confidence reposed in him. What do you mean, by laughing and shaking your head at me? Apostrophe apostrophe, oh, Thomas, Thomas. Apostrophe apostrophe said good child. You had better give me my hat. You had better let me get you that physic. Apostrophe, I will let you get anything you like, including a composing draft for yourself, apostrophe said Thomas, irritably alluding to his fellow apprentice's inexhaustible activity, if you will only sit quiet for 5 minutes longer, and hear me out. I say again the horse is a betrayer of the confidence reposed in him, and that opinion, let me add, is drawn from my own personal experience, and is not based on any fanciful theory whatever. You shall have two instances, two overwhelming instances. Let me start the first of these by asking, what is the distinguishing quality which the Shetland pony has arrogated to himself, and is still perpetually trumpeting through the world by means of popular report and books on natural history? I see the answer in your face. It is the quality of being sure-footed. He professes to have other virtues, such as hardiness and strength, which you may discover on trial, but the one thing which he insists on your believing, when you get on his back, is that he may be safely depended on not to tumble down with you. Very good. Some years ago, I was in Shetland with a party of friends. They insisted on taking me with them to the top of a precipice that overhung the sea. It was a great distance off, but they all determined to walk to it except me. I was wiser then than I was with you at Karak, and I determined to be carried to the precipice. There was no carriage road in the island, and nobody offered in consequence, as I suppose, of the imperfectly civilized state of the country, to bring me a sedan chair, which is naturally what I should have liked best. A Shetland pony was produced instead. I remembered my natural history, I recalled popular report, and I got on the little beast's back, as any other man would have done in my position, placing implicit confidence in the sureness of his feet. And how did he repay that confidence? Brother Francis, carry your mind on from morning to noon. Picture to yourself a howling wilderness of grass and bog, bounded by low stony hills. Pick out one particular spot in that imaginary scene, and sketch me in it, with outstretched arms, curved back, and heels in the air, plunging heat foremost into a black patch of water and mud. Plus just behind me the legs, the body, and the head of a sure-footed Shetland pony, all stretched flat on the ground, and you will have produced an accurate representation of a very lamentable fact. And the moral device, Francis, of this picture will be, to testify that when gentlemen put confidence in the legs of Shetland ponies, they will find to their cost, that they are leaning on nothing but broken reeds. There is my first instance, and what have you got to say to that? Apostrophe apostrophe, nothing, but that I want my hat, apostrophe answered good child, starting up and walking restlessly about the room. You shall have it in a minute, apostrophe rejoined Thomas. My second instance, good child groaned, and sat down again. My second instance is more appropriate to the present time and place, for it refers to a racehorse. 2 years ago an excellent friend of mine, who was desirous of prevailing on me to take regular exercise, and who was well enough acquainted with the weakness of my legs, to expect no very active compliance with his wishes on their part, offered to make me a present of one of his horses. Hearing that the animal in question had started in life on the turf, I declined accepting the gift with many thanks, adding, by way of explanation, that I looked on a racehorse as a kind of embodied hurricane, upon which no sane man of my character and habits could be expected to seat himself. My friend replied that, however appropriate my metaphor might be as applied to racehorses in general, it was singularly unsuitable as applied to the particular horse which he proposed to give me. From a foal upwards this remarkable animal had been the idlest and most sluggish of his race. Whatever capacities for speed he might possess he had kept so strictly to himself that no amount of training had ever brought them out. He had been found hopelessly slow as a racer, and hopelessly lazy as a hunter, and was fit for nothing but a quiet easy life of it with an old gentleman or an invalid. When I heard this account of the horse, I don't mind confessing that my heart warmed to him. Visions of Thomas Idle ambling serenely on the back of a steed as lazy as himself, presenting to a restless world the soothing and composite spectacle of a kind of sluggardly centaur, too peaceable in his habits to alarm anybody, swam attractively before my eyes. I went to look at the horse in the stable. Nice fellow! He was fast asleep with a kitten on his back. I saw him taken out for an airing by the groom. If he had had trousers on his legs I should not have known them from my own, so deliberately were they lifted up, so gently were they put down, so slowly did they get over the ground. From that moment I gratefully accepted my friend's offer. I went home. The horse followed me by a slow train. Oh, Francis, how devoutly I believed in that horse how carefully I looked after all his little comforts. I had never gone the length of hiring a manservant to wait on myself, but I went to the expense of hiring one to wait upon him. If I thought a little of myself, when I bought the softest saddle that could be had for money, I thought also of my horse. When the man at the shop afterwards offered me spurs and a whip, I turned from him with horror. When I sallied out for my first ride, I went purposely unarmed with the means of hurrying my steed. He proceeded at his own pace every step of the way, and when he stopped, at last, and blew out both his sides with a heavy sigh, and turned his sleepy head and looked behind him, I took him home again, as I might take home an artless child who said to me, "If you please, sir, I am tired." For a week this complete harmony between me and my horse lasted undisturbed. At the end of that time, when he had made quite sure of my friendly confidence in his laziness, when he had thoroughly acquainted himself with all the little weaknesses of my seat and their name as legion, the smoldering treachery and ingratitude of the equine nature blazed out in an instant. Without the slightest provocation from me, with nothing passing him at the time, but a pony chaise driven by an old lady, he started in one instant from a state of sluggish depression to a state of frantic high spirits. He kicked, he plunged, he shied, he pranced, he capered fearfully. I sat on him, as long as I could, and when I could sit no longer, I fell off. No, Francis. This is not a circumstance to be laughed at, but to be wept over. What would be said of a man who had requited my kindness in that way? Range over all the rest of the animal. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.